You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. Living on Gumbunya country in Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Sandy. Welcome back to Talk the Walk. My guest today is Sammy Lilly, a recent graduate in the Masters of Social Work from the University of the Sunshine Coast. For several years now, Sammy has been actively involved with ANTAR Queensland, Australians for Native Title and Reconciliation, initially undertaking her first social work placement and staying on as a management committee member. Whether it is behind the desk researching and writing, or taking to the street, Sammy has been at the forefront of Aboriginal policy issues, social justice and advocacy. Sammy heads up the child removal campaign at ANTAR and is a member of the National Campaign Advisory Council. She is also a member of the ASW Queensland First Nations Vitality Practice Group, the ASW Queensland Reconciliation Action Plan Committee, and supports Grandmothers Against Removals, marching alongside Auntie Karen Fusi and other passionate aunties and grannies in Sydney. In her spare time, Sammy mentors Aboriginal students at the Barunga Centre at the university where she has been studying. Sammy says her career goal is to create equitable and just outcomes for First Nations people. Ever since I read Sammy's article in the ASW Autumn Edition of Social Work Focus, I've been keen to catch up with Sammy and find out what makes this incredibly committed woman tick. And here we are. Sammy, welcome to Talk the Walk and thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me. It's lovely to talk to you today.
Firstly, congratulations on completing your studies. That must be a huge relief to be now graduated.
Yes, it's all still a little bit surreal at this point, but yeah, it's good to have a closure to the 3.5 years that I've been there.
Yeah, awesome. That's an incredible introduction I've just given. You've been working so hard, obviously, on your placement and in a voluntary capacity. Yeah, I was wondering if you could comment on why social work students that are currently studying should consider perhaps taking on a placement in a place like ANTAR and what opportunities that provides for students.
It's a different path for social work students to take. Often everyone is directed into direct practice, and obviously there's, you know, a huge need for social workers in that area. That's where probably predominantly all the work and everything is. But policy and advocacy is certainly a part of what I believe a social worker should also be doing. So you're working at the micro level, but you've got to be working at the systems and macro level as well. And so to do a placement like I did with ANTAR Queensland, it just gave insight into, you know, the other areas that social work and social workers need to make a difference.
So you were saying that the CEO now considers you a bit of an expert in child removal policy. How does that sit with you?
Yeah, I really struggle with that because I suppose all I've done is research. I've looked at all the research. I've read lots of reports from the peak bodies, a lot of Claire Tilbury's work. So I sort of still feel that I'm just reiterating what other researchers and academics and peak bodies are saying. But I guess the thing is with policy and advocacy and doing submissions and things like that, we all have to keep adding our voice to the cause to make the change. So I guess it's still valuable what I'm doing. I am a bit humbled by it all.
So let's look at what exactly you did do when you were with ANTAR. In 2016, you wrote ANTAR's submission regarding proposed changes to the Queensland Child Protection Act. And in October last year, all the proposed recommendations within the Child Protection Reform Amendment Bill were passed by the Queensland government. Have you seen any noticeable changes in the way the department is now handling child protection issues in Queensland? And is this making a difference to the number of Aboriginal children being removed?
Unfortunately, it's too early to see any of the data reflecting a decrease in the numbers of Aboriginal children, or Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, I should say, going into out-of-home care. But certainly Queensland is now the first state to have a generational strategy in place. And the strategy is actually to be overseen by an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander representative body. So, you know, that's definitely a huge step in the right direction. There's been a lot of commitment from the Queensland government. QuadCIP, which is the peak body in Queensland, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peak body, they are heavily involved in what's going on. So, you know, it's at least promising in terms of more self-determination around the issue. And that's one of the changes that was made to the Queensland Child Protection Act. They actually put in a principle of self-determination. So there's certainly positive steps. It's just, I suppose, time to see how this flows through.
So when you say self-determination, what does that actually look like?
Well, it's meant to be self-determination, as is set out in the UNDRIP, in the United Nations Declaration of Rights of Indigenous People. And so it's about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people developing their own determining what the problems are and then developing their own solutions to the problems, rather than often being a top-down approach. So the government determines, you know, what are the issues and where the funding goes and who gets the funding. It needs to be that obviously Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are making all those decisions themselves.
So how does Queensland compare to the other states now that Queensland has adopted this policy of self-determination? What do you see as the main differences between the states?
Well, interestingly, and this is the statistics that comes from the Family Matters 2017 report card, and they'll release another report card this year for 2018. They actually released their inaugural report card in 2016. They've been comparing the states on a number of areas. And whilst Queensland, actually, the overrepresentation sits at about 8.5 times for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children in out-of-home care. And up against the other states, that's not too bad. In fact, it's quite good. But nevertheless, 8.5 times is a massive overrepresentation. And there are also issues with the placement rate of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children in Queensland, with only 55.3% of children placed with either kin or Indigenous carers. So that's an area that still needs to be addressed. But, yeah, I mean, Queensland is doing not too badly in the scheme of things. And certainly we are one of two states now that has the changes to the Child Protection Act that actually allow for the delegation of powers with regards to decision-making of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children for out-of-home care. Those delegation of powers can be given across to the CEO of an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander organisation. And whilst that hasn't occurred yet, again, it's a huge step forward to at least have that legislation changed to allow that to occur.
Like you've mentioned, the data clearly shows nationally we'd still have a lot of work to do. Despite Kevin Rudd's apology to the Stolen Generations 10 years ago, we've seen child removals continuing to climb. Now we have Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children representing 35% of all kids in out-of-home care, despite only representing 5.5% of the total population. From the research that you've done while you were at ANTAR, what do you see as important in addressing this nationally?
There's a couple of things that have been called for. Most recently, the Australian Law Reform Commission, they were doing an inquiry into the incarceration rates of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. And given links between out-of-home care and then the trajectory into juvenile justice system, ANTAR Queensland put forward a submission around this, saying that we really need to address the issue of overrepresentation in out-of-home care, in the child protection system. And so what's come back from that and from a number of other organisations is that there should be a national inquiry into the child protection laws and processes that affect Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. So that's one area that has been called for. And another one is a lot of organisations have called for targets. So like justice targets for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, also national targets for the number of children in the child protection system.
So can you talk a bit about what ANTAR is going to keep doing by putting pressure on our government to make sure we get policy right? Because it seems to me that unless we take a dramatically different approach, the trends are just going to continue.
So we've continued to be a part of the Queensland Family Matters Leadership Group. So we meet on a regular basis with a number of other, well, with QuatSIP as the peak body, and a number of other Aboriginal organisations, QCOS, various, you know, stakeholders. And we'll continue to write submissions as required. We use our newsletter and our website and our Facebook page as a platform to raise awareness around this issue because, interestingly, lots of people are not aware that, the rate of Aboriginal child removal is so high. People talk about stolen generations and a lot of people that I speak to don't realise that, the numbers are massively overrepresented currently. So we'll just continue supporting as an ally and an advocate the other Aboriginal organisations.
So we'll put some links to the website and perhaps where people can sign up for the ANTAR newsletter in the show notes today. But what else could social workers that are listening now, what could they do to support these initiatives?
There are a couple of different ways of supporting the Family Matters Initiative, which is the national campaign around the overrepresentation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children in the child protection system. There's a statement of commitment that organisations can sign, and there's also a pledge that individuals can take. So that might be a couple of links that, could also be placed there.
And what about if you're not from Queensland, is there a local organisation like ANTAR in each state that perhaps people could link into as well or not?
There is an ANTAR national body that people could become members of or receive their newsletters, look at their website. We do have representation in other states. The states vary in their different advocacy campaigns. So ANTAR Queensland and ANTAR National are the only two that are actually looking specifically at child removal. So some of the other states have other Indigenous issues that they support.
Great. So there's lots of resources for people to go out and find and read more about it.
Absolutely. And more than just, as I said, the child removal issue, there's native title, there's incarceration, there's stolen wages, close the gap, refresh, a considerable number of issues that ANTAR as a whole look into.
Awesome. And so just looking back on your placement with ANTAR and the other things that you've been doing in the Indigenous area, what's been your greatest learning so far?
Look, I think one of the things that's just been amazing is the relationships that I've developed and just, I don't know, how welcomed I've been made by community, by aunties, by grandmothers. You know, I think if you go in to any of this and you're very genuine in your intent and you're very transparent and very honest, and that you actually do things rather than just talk about doing things, then, you know, it's so lovely to gain the trust of a group of people that, you know, as a social worker, we're often on often acting in conflict to, like, self-determination and all that. Yeah, systemic racism, a whole lot of things. And so it's really lovely to then gain the trust. It's a privilege to gain the trust of a cohort of people who have, you know, every right to be fairly wary of a white social worker.
Well said. And while we're on the topic of social work practice, I'm wondering if you might speak a bit about your framework in terms of, I guess, the theories or approaches that you've held as this work has been unfolding. I'm aware that you've been on a long and critical learning journey throughout your studies. So can you speak a bit about, your social work practice framework from a theoretical perspective and what you've held as important?
Yeah, absolutely. So right from the beginning of the social work degree, I made a commitment to try and use all my assessment pieces to address Aboriginal issues and develop as much cultural safety as I could by really focusing on the theories that are supported, generally speaking, by Aboriginal practitioners themselves. So there's a decolonised approach, so just acknowledging Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander ways of knowing, being and doing, you know, understanding the history of social work and its Eurocentric practices and our role here in this country in terms of child removal and other issues like that. So decolonised approach was, you know, a huge one for me. Very interested in whiteness theory, again, just, you know, reflecting on my own culture, you know, and how I am privileged within, the Eurocentric culture that we're in, human rights, and then all of those, I guess, are really kind of under the overarching critical theory. And then as in terms of like an actual direct practice approach, I specifically went and did a narrative therapy workshop, and it was delivered by an Aboriginal facilitator. So it was through an Aboriginal lens. Mm-hmm. And that was just a fantastic workshop to be in. It was amazing. And again, narrative approaches are sort of recognised as similar to yarning and all that. So mm-hmm. Very interested in narrative therapy because it aligns really well with the yarning approach that Aboriginal people have to discuss things. So I was really keen to do that. And then I'm also sort of interested in the future, if I do further study, there's the academic Bob Pease who talks about pro-feminism because he is a male social worker. There was a lot of tension around whether or not you could call yourself or say that you're a feminist practitioner or using feminist theory. And so he has done work around pro-feminism. So likewise, I'm interested in exploring the idea of pro-Indigenous. Whether or not Indigenous is the right word, I'm not sure. Maybe it's pro-Aboriginal. I'm not sure. And even that Aboriginal is not reflecting the diversity of culture that exists. But wanting to acknowledge Aboriginal ways of knowing, being and doing, but I can't claim them because I am not Indigenous. So, yeah, I'm very interested in developing something around that, perhaps.
Did he come up with this term pro-Indigenous, or is that something that you're considering?
That's mine, unless somebody else has written it somewhere, which I haven't been able to find because I have done a little bit of sort of, you know, cursory research into. But, yeah, again, you know, that's that the language would be very important. So whether or not that's the right language or the right, you know, way of referring to it, but certainly being able to use a culturally safe framework for social work practitioners but not then colonising or, you know, taking Indigenous knowledge as my own when I'm not Indigenous.
Sounds great. I hope to interview you again on that. If you find out more and develop this approach, that'd be fantastic.
I need to have a break from study first.
So just in talking with you in the last 20 minutes or so, I mean, you have an obvious drive and passion for this work. I'm wondering, what is it that inspires you? What is it that brought you to this work initially? And, yeah, what keeps you going?
Well, interestingly, my first degree was a business degree. I'm not quite sure what I was thinking. And I ended up going into a graduate banking role after my business degree. And no offense to the banks, but some of my values just did not sit with like the whole capitalist system. Mm-hmm. And I just realized that helping people, I had actually been working in mental health for about 3 years, and I just really thought, no, this is where I'm supposed to be. I'm meant to be assisting people. And then the advocacy, I've always just had a real sense of, I don't know, that people should just be treated fairly and equitably. I really am passionate about discrimination. It upsets me enormously. When I think back, I'd written in year 8 an essay on gay rights because we were given, you know, write an essay on a controversial subject. And I wrote about the discrimination towards gay people back then. And another thing I can remember having is it's Peter English's book, Birthrights, Land Rights, The Great Australian Hoax, I think is what it's called. So I just had a sense of treating people fairly from, I don't know, a young age, and social work ended up being the right avenue for me.
And you also have a bit of a personal connection to ending up in the issue of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander social work?
Yeah, I've got Aboriginal family through marriage down in New South Wales, and I've had a lifetime relationship with a man who was adopted at birth and had no knowledge of his cultural background, who his family was until probably in his mid-20s, and then didn't actually find his birth mother until more like his mid-30s. And so I got a very upfront and personal experience of not knowing your family, not knowing your culture, and how much impact that can make on somebody. And so, yeah, that kind of, I think that sparked my interest in the first place. And then, you know, the more I got, you know, the deeper the relationships and everything that I developed with my family down in New South Wales, you know, it was just, I could see the racism that occurred. I would hear stories. So I think, you know, when you're touched by something personally, it's a huge motivator.
Can you think of a particular example where it sort of really touched those fiery buttons and you thought, geez, I've got to do something about this?
Look, there's a lot of stories. One that springs to mind is a family member who was trying to take a TV out of their relative's old age facility because the person had passed away, and they were actually questioned as to whether or not they were stealing that television. And just the circumstances in the story, it was so evident that they were being questioned, and the way they were then treated was purely based on race. But that's just one story of many, and that's a pretty minor story. There's plenty of other stories with the aunties and children being removed where there's just no cause. And then, you know, people have to argue to get the children back and everything, and it's really great when they do get them back, when they're able to, like, substantiate that nothing's going on, but there is still just systemic racism.
This sort of touches on my next question, which was going to be around challenges and some of the struggles that you faced along the way, because obviously these are really difficult topics and issues that you're coming up against. So as a non-Indigenous person practicing social work with Indigenous people, what are sort of the challenges that you've faced so far on your journey?
I have to say I'm very, very fortunate that I am able to place myself. So, you know, for me, the relationship development is absolutely key. I always make certain that I say, you know, who my connections are. So, you know, it gives me a starting point at least. Mm-hmm. But, yes, I've still had instances where, you know, people have sort of said, well, who are you and like, why are you here? You're not Aboriginal, you know. And then I have to kind of either rely on the relationships that I have with other Aboriginal people, and I've had an auntie vouch for me in the past and say, no, it's okay. She's, you know, she's here with us. She's an ally. She's an advocate. She's not, you know, she's not the enemy. And other than that, just taking a lot of time. And as I said, being genuine and honest and acting with integrity, you know, usually that's picked up upon pretty quickly. So I've I think I've been quite fortunate. But I'm aware of the fact that at every, you know, potential meeting of somebody I don't know, they're very much within their rights to go, oh, well, you know, you're the coloniser here. We don't want to know. And I've just got to have and I know that we've got a lecturer at my uni, Dr. Bindi Bennett, and she talks about cultural courage and that, you know, despite the fact that I'm non-Indigenous, to me it's part of my duty to make changes within the non-Indigenous perspectives. So despite what I come up against, I've just, you know, if I want to do what I'm doing, I've got to just continue.
So it sounds like, despite the effect that this might have on you, that it doesn't really stop you. You just get up and keep going.
Well, yeah, because I think what I might face is, you know, a drop in the ocean in comparison to the racism that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people face. If I sit and feel uncomfortable for 5 minutes, that doesn't even compare to the uncomfortability that, you know, that 200 odd years Aboriginal people have had to sit with. So, yeah, it's fine. I'm happy to sit with that uncomfortability.
So sitting with the discomfort, having allies and Aboriginal people that can vouch for you, they're some of the things that have helped you overcome the challenges. Would you think there are any other skills or things that you've developed that have helped you as a non-Indigenous person practicing Indigenous social work?
Listening. I am quite a talker, and so I have to be very, very aware that I'm not, again, using my position of privilege to just talk over other people. And so I make a really conscious effort to make sure I'm listening for a change. Because, that's really, really important. Mm. And being, you know, again, open to other people's perspectives of how things are viewed, like, you know, the connection to land and things like that. Just because I may not understand how the connection to land might work doesn't mean that it's not valid for people. It's like whether or not I believe in God, just, you know, if that person believes in it, it's not up to me to tell them that they can't.
Is there any particular knowledge that you think social workers should have when engaging in this kind of work?
Unfortunately, social workers or university students in general, I still don't think we know enough of the history of what's occurred in this country. Mm. And until there's more truth telling around that, it's hard to get people to change their views when they don't even really understand what's occurred here. So I think, a lot more sort of actual fundamental knowledge on the history of Australia and the colonising, you know, factors and everything, and the removal of children and the stolen wages and all of that. That's really important. And another area of interest to me in social work at university level is further incorporation of Aboriginal perspectives and ways of knowing, being and doing. I think we can go a lot further with that as well.
So tell us about the masters which you've just done. How well did they cover those kinds of things in the master?
Considering I've only been to the one university, it's difficult for me to ascertain how much cultural knowledge and worldviews and stuff like that are delivered in other universities. But as a general kind of consideration, I think all universities probably should be incorporating more Aboriginal worldviews. Mm. You know, Aboriginal people are overrepresented in every area virtually that social workers end up working in. Mm. It's imperative that we know how to safely practice with this cohort of people. Like, it's really important. So I think all universities could probably improve.
So you've talked about some of the skills that are really important to you, like listening and being open to other people's perspectives and being honest about our history. Can you speak about some of, I guess, the values or beliefs underpinning these principles? Because it seems to me like they're not just values and principles that we're born with, but they are developed.
The fairness and equity is so important to me. I just feel very, very strongly about treating people with respect and dignity and equitably. You know, that's been an interesting concept that the social work degree has, I suppose, given me. I always would have said equally, but I now have a far better understanding of what equal might, you know, result in. Mm-hmm. And so now it's that equity that everyone's on a level playing field. And, mm-hmm. and you know, that goes to bigger issues globally. I have concerns about how equitable, you know, the whole world's population is and feel strongly that it shouldn't be as as disparate as what it like as what it is. So
you mentioned that in the social work degree, it kind of firmed up some of these values for you, but often they are derived from childhood or, you know, sometime in our lives previously. Can you think back to a time when perhaps, you know, fairness and equity was something that you learnt pretty early on in life?
I guess it must have been as a result of my family, which I suppose most of the time that's where these things come from. My dad was a builder and he went to great lengths to always try and ensure that people could get, that it was back in the days of the first home loan grants, like way, way, way back. And my parents would go out of their way to ensure that people could get into their first home. They were just really fair, equitable people and it rubbed off. It was just like, do the right thing by people. Be honest. Oh, well, I got the work hard, but but I have issues around that these days. But, yeah, no, they were very, very fair and it definitely rubbed off on me.
Speaking of role models, have there been other people that have been really influential in the kind of work you've been doing in the last 3 or 4 years?
I guess my parents are still definitely role models, although as an adult, you know, you eventually realise that your parents aren't as perfect as what you thought they might have been. We have some political debates and things like that. In the context of this work specifically, I've got family members, like I've got an auntie down in Sydney who is so incredibly supportive of me. You know, I really value her respect. Auntie Karen Fusey from Grandmothers Against Removals, or in Brisbane it's Sovereign Women United. She's just inspirational. She has had a number of her children pass away under very challenging circumstances, and so she raises her grandchildren and her own daughter and does work in community. You know, she's just incredible. I think she's an amazing, strong woman. And then, other people, like I suppose Ross Daniels, the president of ANTAR Queensland, he's been incredibly supportive of me and he's given me a lot of direction in terms of policy and things like that, because he's been heavily involved in Amnesty International for years and involved with the Labor Party and various things. So he's given me, I suppose, some more actual technical skills, I guess, and support. There's been a lot of people. It's hard to pin them down to just one or two. I mean, I've met some amazing, strong aunties and stuff down in Sydney at the marches, like Auntie Jenny Munro, and it's been incredible.
In terms of theoretical knowledge, which you talked about a bit earlier, and some of the theories that you were using in your work while you're at ANTAR, is there any particular writers that you enjoy reading?
I have read a number of Dr. Bindi Bennett's journal articles. Dr. Christine Fedjo-King is another academic who I purchased her first book quite a while ago, and I actually was fortunate enough to have a telephone conversation with her explaining why I wanted to purchase the book and everything. So, yeah, she's another author. Who else have I got? I've got Please Knock Before You Enter. I'm not good with names and titles of books.
Well, maybe you could send me a bit of a list of your favourites and I can put those up on the show notes as well if people want to follow them
Absolutely. Honestly, I have a filing cabinet, a four-drawer filing cabinet just jam-packed with journal articles on either Aboriginal issues or, like, culturally safe ways of then addressing them or,
So what does the future hold for you, Sammy? How do you think, your work might play out in the future? I know that you've just recently graduated and there must be just so many options for you. Where do you think you might be heading?
I would really like to go into policy. Ideally, I'd love to be in an Aboriginal peak body, but I understand that, you know, they're not huge organisations necessarily. Again, as a non-Indigenous person, I totally understand that, you know, if employment is given to Aboriginal people or Torres Strait Islander people first, absolutely, they're best placed. That's what self-determination is, that they're doing that. So maybe policy still within state government, but certainly I'd like to try and change some of the systemic and macro kind of issues. Yeah, so and then if I was doing direct practice, I would prefer to be in an Aboriginal organisation within like the family preservation space.
Great. Just on reflection, as we get to the end of our hour together, have you got a nice good news story you'd like to share, maybe your proudest moment? Or
I guess there were a couple of moments where I really felt like, you know, my work contributed to something, and one of them was the changes to the Queensland Child Safety Act. You know, again, as I said, many organisations put submissions in, but it was nice to see that, you know, ANTAR Queensland's voice was amongst them. And, you know, it's they're in Hansard and all of that, so that was pretty exciting. And the other one is also to do with the Australian Law Reform Commission and their inquiry. And, again, sort of seeing ANTAR Queensland quoted in their report was, yeah, I don't know, it was kind of like, whoa, okay.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I don't know. It was quite exciting.
Yeah. What about mistakes? Have you ever made any boo-boos that you want to confess, or maybe you can just talk more generally on what you think might be some of the biggest mistakes that non-Indigenous social workers make?
I'm sure I've got hundreds of mistakes that I've made. I've probably blocked them out.
They are good learnings though, aren't they? And if people can point them out to you, how valuable is that?
Yeah, no, it is really valuable. I mean, yeah. I don't know. I think you just have to be so mindful of your language all the time. And given that I, you know, am quite a talker, I have to almost slow myself down and say, all right, be thinking really carefully, because language holds a lot of power. Just be mindful of how you're saying stuff and how things can be misconstrued. You know, I'm bound to have said things that have come out wrong over the course, you know, the last few years, but people have obviously been very forgiving. I think that would be one of the big things for me, is just being really careful of how things are framed and thinking before you open your mouth.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the issue of power, because I think that's so important, isn't it? And through our language, we can create power or disempower too.
Absolutely, which is why, you know, again, I try to be really mindful of what I'm saying before I just say it.
Well, on behalf of everyone listening, I just want to say thank you for, yeah, the work that you've been doing with ANTAR as a student. I think it's just incredible, and I hope that it inspires other social work students that might be listening to consider a placement such as that. It's not very often that you come across placements like that. So well done. Thank you.
You're welcome.
For setting an example for the rest of us to follow. And just in wrapping up, if people want to find out more information, obviously we'll have some links to those things that you've already mentioned. But if people maybe want to connect with you in person or follow up on something with you, how might they do that?
Oh, look, I'm happy for people to email me. That's not a problem.
Okay. Well, I'll put your email address also in the show notes. And is there other ways, either through social media, that people can follow you, or not really?
As a part of a commitment to advocacy as a social worker, I do have a Facebook page that I oversee, and it's Ally Through Advocacy. You know, I don't have a big following or anything like that, but it was just another thing that I considered was important to do rather than to talk about.
And so what's the focus of your Facebook page?
I repost various stories, etc., about Indigenous issues, basically. So not necessarily just child removal or overrepresentation of Aboriginal children in out-of-home care and Torres Strait Islander children in out-of-home care, but actually just general issues. So it could be pieces from the conversation, it could be policy documents. I go and look for resources myself, and whatever I find that is related to the topic, I'll repost that.
All right, so we'll put that in the show notes as well. And just in finishing up, is there anything else that you'd like to say that we haven't covered?
Oh, I can't think of anything else.
Some final words of advice for maybe social work students out there that might be considering a placement in this area? What would you say to them?
I would say for students who are in, like, well, I think all students, to be honest, I think students just about should do a placement in, you know, some Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander related organisation or area of practice. Yeah, I think that would be really, really valuable for everyone to do that. And, yeah, just go with an open mind and an open heart and listen and learn.
Beautiful. Lovely words to finish on. Thank you so much, Sammy. And, yeah, once again, thank you for all the work that you've done in this area over the last few years. And I wish you all the best for the future, whatever that holds for you.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute honour to be talking with you. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story, music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.